This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
This is it, part five, the final segment of my interview with Blanca Simpson. Over the past four parts, we've walked through her entire journey with the Murdaugh family. From meeting Alec in the late 90s to becoming the family's trusted housekeeper to the secrets Maggie confided to the morning of June 7th to walking into that house 12 hours after the murders and seeing things that didn't add up. Now, we get to the hard questions. Does Blanca think Alec Murdaugh killed his wife and son? Why does she think he did it? Does she believe he deserves a new trial? And after testifying against him, after everything, where does she stand with Buster today? This is the conclusion. Here's part five. What do you think happened here? Do you think that that is the reason that this took place? Do you even think Alec is the one who was behind the weapon? Or do you think Alec was more, you know, what sort of role do you think he played in this?
There have been so many people trying to theorize on that. And my personal theory is what I wrote in the book. Plan A did not go well. Trying to get in contact with the Mr. Rowe to come out there to the property. I think plan A was totally, you know, off. And when Mr. Rowe didn't show up, he had to go to plan B. And plan B was planting that seed that perhaps it was the kids on. And I don't mean no disrespect when I call them kids, but to me, they're kids. You know, I have kids their age. Yeah. But that started his story about, you know, the boat, you know, the people on the boat could have done it and so forth. What he forgot, though, was that while he was testifying in court, when they asked him about was anybody else out there, during the time that that Bubba takes that chicken in his mouth, and Maggie's talking and Paul's talking, and you kind of hear him interact a little bit right there.
You cut out there, Blanca. Go ahead. You cut out there. Pick it up from that time where they're talking the chicken getting at something.
From the time that Bubba got the chicken in his mouth, and you could hear Maggie, you heard Paul, and then you hear Alec. The dogs are not alerting, especially the bloodhound that sat on the end of the kennels. They were very sensitive when other people were out there that they did not recognize. They were very familiar with M3. That's why you don't hear them.
Yeah.
And even Alex said it in court when he was asked. He said the dogs didn't sense anybody else out there. Yeah. So there's been a lot of people that say, well, so-and-so could have come on there. Well, you can tell when he's on the phone with 911 that somebody else is out there. You could hear the dogs. Mm-hmm. As quiet as Alec is trying to be on that phone, if you listen to the tape, you can hear the dogs. You can even hear Bubba whimpering in the background. And you can hear the other dogs anxious in the background while he's on 911. And then however they tried to have their say-so about why he said here. He said here to whoever was out there helping him. Take something or here, take this or whatever. So the dogs were alerting at that point. The dogs were very anxious. You could hear them in the background. When he says here, it's not that he's talking to the 911 dispatcher, because if you hear the call, he doesn't really answer why he says here. It's a lot of, he's kind of like leading him into that question as he's talking to him, Mr. Griffin. Yeah. So he doesn't really answer that. And then Alex himself said, in his testimony about the dogs didn't sense. There was nobody else there. The dogs weren't, you know, they didn't sense anybody. And I have been from the time that I heard that video and I started kind of settling down, there's no way that there wasn't anybody else out there other than Maggie, Paul, and Alec. The other people that arrived, the cleaners that I call them, arrived after to help. And I think he made that call. I messed up. I need for y'all to, you know, I need for y'all to come to my house. You know, something happened. I don't believe that they got there or that they helped him in any way with the crime. That's not my theory. My theory is that they helped him. You know, by the time they arrived, it was already too late for Maggie and Paul.
Do you think Alec is the one who pulled the trigger?
I do. There's too little time for, and the dogs are not, like I said, the dogs alert. Though that bloodhound and the little, the one that they call Tappy Toes, it's like a small version of an Irish setter is what I call it. Those dogs would alert. And they're not.
Why do you think he did it? I mean, for knowing what you know, how tight of a unit they were, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense that he would. I mean, I get the familial side. Do you think it has something? Would Alec have done this if he had been in a different mind state? If the drugs weren't part of the equation? If all this stress is dad dying, the boat crash, all these things? Was it a perfect storm and you got this bizarre version of Alec that Alec didn't even know at that moment in time that did this? Or was this just the deep down real piece of Alec where he saw no other options out of all of these things, and the only thing he could go for would be some empathy where the person whose spouse was just murdered and son just murdered and woe is me? What do you think was going on there in his mind?
What I believe is he knew that, the motion to compel was coming up that Thursday.
Yeah.
He already knew that. He had been confronted about the money that was missing. His father, yes, his father was dying. He knew that. We all knew that. Mm-hmm. The stress from that. He was very close to his dad. But the motion to compel, he knew his dad was dying. His dad could not help him. The only solution to that was all the properties. He would inherit all. A prime example that would give him the assets to come up with the money and put that money away. Nobody would have probably ever known that he taken, you know, that money, because he would have had enough time. And he knew that. He was very smart. Alec is very smart. And he knew, I think out of desperation, he might have snapped. Because of the fact that the motion to compel was coming up and he was going to have his financial crimes were going to be, you know, they were going to find out about him.
Yeah.
And that was just a way for him to get the sympathy of the people, you know, based on what had happened. And, you know, like I said, all of the properties, everything was going to go to him. He wasn't stupid. All of the properties were under Maggie's name. So the person, the spouse, was going to be entitled to all of that. So it makes perfect sense that he knew what was about to happen, and he didn't want it to happen. And unfortunately, he made a decision that is unforgivable.
I always say all roads, narcissism always wins. Not the narcissist, narcissism, because it destroys anyone who practices it. And it seems like this may be exactly what happens. Do you think, in your perspective, when you look at everything, where it sits right now, and if he did snap, if this was just some, you know, insane moment of his, do you think Alec believes he did this?
I think he's in denial. I just think he's in denial. He's never. Will he ever? He ultimately, the only person that knows what happened, the truth about this, is him. Whether he will ever tell us, you know, that's for us to sit here and guess. Will he ever say something? Well, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it makes you wonder.
I don't believe it. No. He's going to continue with a narrative that somebody else did it, that he's basically innocent, that he didn't, because he knows the stigma that goes behind with killing your wife and your child. He knows that. And he wants that sympathy from the people, you know, that he lost his wife and his child, you know, in a brutal way. But
it makes you wonder, like, does he even remember this happening, or is it something he's blocked out and is now literally just drinking his own Kool-Aid and believing the narrative?
When I watched him at when he gave his statement, I honestly thought that he would speak differently in front of the judge. I was hoping, let me put it that way, that he would speak differently. Mm-hmm. To kind of give me the Alec that I knew from the past. And he didn't do that. He made it about him. He made it about, oh, poor me, you know, I'm struggling, you know, I lost my wife. And I understand that. But then to stand up there and basically not acknowledge the pain that he caused, the pain that not only to her family, but to all of us that, you know, to the few of us that were close to Maggie and Paul. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that even the kids that were on the boat with Paul, they mm-hmm. might not have been talking, but those kids have a heart. And they deserved better. And his arrogance came through more than, you know, if you want empathy from people, you have to show that in the way that you speak to people. And in court, he made it all about him and not about any of the people that he hurt. Yeah. I didn't see that. The only concern was Buster. And I understand, you know, that's his only son, you know, the son that he's got left. But what about the families? What about the families that you destroyed along the way? What about, you know, your the people that were hurt? Mm-hmm. He didn't have that remorse. He didn't have that sympathy towards him. I mean, he just did not have that. It was an arrogance. It was it's almost like he put on a show to show people that this is who, you know, I am.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to come up honest as harsh, you know, but it was shocking to me when they arrested him.
Yeah.
Because I didn't expect it at that moment. But then once I started putting things together, as I had enough time to go over, you know, some of the stuff, and I wasn't looking at what the police officers were looking at. I was not looking at that. I was looking at the tire tracks behind him when he was talking to Officer Green. I was looking at the towel that didn't make sense, the clothes that were left in the bathroom, the puddle of water. Those are the things that I was looking at. Maggie's car parked on the wrong side. Those are the clues that I was looking at. I don't care about, you know, of course the forensics had a lot to do with it, you know, when they, whatever it was that they did, you know, the bullets and all of that. But to me, it was certain things that just did not fit the puzzle.
Yeah.
And
personal things that don't fit the puzzle.
Exactly. There was a lot of things that just did not fit the puzzle. And I think there was a lot of deflection, you know, everything was deflected towards me. mm-hmm. you know, certain things that weren't done or whatever. It's like, oh, well, the maid cleaned up, you know, or she mm-hmm. did this. She straightened out. I'm sorry. You know, there for a while, I felt that. I really yeah. did. I felt that. But the one thing that I feel good about is the fact that I was not in law enforcement, and it was not my responsibility to serve that warrant on that home.
Yeah.
So as far as using me, it was easy for people to deflect everything on me and saying, oh, she cleaned up, she did this. And I'm over that. I didn't do anything wrong. I wasn't.
No.
I didn't do anything wrong.
I wouldn't. I don't take it that way at all. You were doing what you were supposed to be doing, and nor did you have the benefit of you know hindsight to see everything that's going on. No one knew what was going on at those moments in time.
Yeah.
You know, so you were doing what you were supposed to be doing at that moment.
Yes.
I know you have Bubba, correct?
I do.
How is Bubba?
Bubba's had some, I've had some touch and go moments with him, but he was diagnosed with diabetes. Okay. He started having seizures before I got him. I know Maggie had to take him in in the middle of the night because he was having seizures.
Yeah.
But he was doing well on the medication and everything. So, once I got him, I guess it was an adjustment period for him. Some days he would eat, some days he didn't want to eat.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I noticed within days, he was eating normal. He was drinking water. He was doing everything normal. But I noticed that he was not gaining weight. And yeah. that's when I rushed him and I found out that he was diabetic. They tested him. They ran all kinds of labs on him. I found out he was diabetic. So we got him on the medication, the insulin. We finally got that under control. He wore a meter for some time, you know, to kind of get his readings.
Yeah.
It was really hard on me at first. Because every 2 to 3 hours, if the meter would alert, I would have to be right there to see, you know, whether,
yeah.
you know, what I needed to do, yeah. give him food or water, whatever he needed. And it was touch and go there for a while, but
sure.
I'm so thankful that I got a great team that, has helped me control his diabetes
yeah.
and, given him, you know, he did go almost completely. He can see shadows, but he can't really see.
Yeah.
But he's doing fairly well. He knows the run of the house. He knows where his bed is. He knows everything.
Good.
I mean, he gets around pretty good, and he does. He's very clingy, and he follows me around. I think his sense of, he just knows.
Yeah.
But he's doing well. He's doing extremely well now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good to hear that Bubba got a good home. You got him, with the blessing of Buster. Do you guys keep in contact after all this?
No, sir.
No.
No. I knew, like I say, I knew after testifying that any kind of relationship, you know, friendship, you know, the relationship, you know, was gonna,
yeah,
it was not gonna be there anymore. I knew that once I testified, you know, of course, and I don't hold any ill feelings. That's his father.
I mean, that's a dynamic
you know, that's still
a personal one.
That's
for
still
him.
His dad.
That'd be one that, I mean,
all I can say
him,
is, Yeah. All I can say is I hope he's happy and sure. I hope he's, I just want him to be happy. And if it meant not ever speaking to me again, as long as he's happy and he's living his life according to what Buster wants to do and not what anybody else wants him to do. And he's happy. I don't care if, as long as he's happy, even if he doesn't speak to me, it's okay. I'm okay with that. But I just want to see him happy and as best he can and go on with his life and, you know, for people to let him be who he is, you know, let him live his life.
Let him have his own identity outside of all of this. One more question.
Yes.
Do you think Alec deserves a new trial with all that's going on right now?
If it was up to me, I think I say it in the book where, you know, I think he got a fair trial.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it's not up to me or anyone else that thinks like me. You know, we are all entitled to, you know, a fair trial under the law.
Sure.
Yep. And if that's the case, then, you know, we just have to follow the rule of law. And if the rule of law specifies that he needs to get a new trial, then, you know.
Yeah. It would be, if there would be a new trial, it sounds like you have some information that could be rather valuable to the prosecution that didn't make it into the first one. If they would only listen.
I don't think that they're going to call me to testify.
No. Would be interesting.
I don't.
Yeah. Stranger things have happened, especially around all of this.
I mean, other than to tear away at, you know, the theories that I have or to.
Sure.
You know, other than that, I don't think that they would do that.
It will be fascinating to see what happened. Thank you so much for coming on here today, Blanca, and giving us your insight on what life was like through all of that and your many decades with the Murdaugh family. Thank you again so much. And there it is, 15 years inside the Murdaugh family, a front row seat to their lives, their secrets, and ultimately their destruction. Blanca Simpson didn't just clean their house. She became a part of their world. And when that world collapsed, she was left holding pieces of a puzzle that nobody seemed to want. She tried to help investigators. They told her to get help. She noticed things that didn't fit the story. And in the end, she sat on that witness stand and told the truth, even knowing, though, it would cost her relationship with the only Murdaugh left standing. Whether you agree with all of the theories or not, one thing is clear. Blanca Simpson was there, and her perspective matters. Her book is out now. This is it, Within the House of Murdaugh. If you want to read all of it and get all of her experience, this is the place to do it. It's available wherever books are sold. Love to get your thoughts on our conversation, on this interview. You can check it out on YouTube if you're not already there. You can comment there on YouTube. Be sure to press subscribe as well. And leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We do greatly appreciate that. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Alec Murdaugh is now an alleged murderer. That's right. We have to put alleged back in there because the South Carolina Supreme Court just threw out his conviction. That's right, kids. Alec Murdaugh is very likely going back to trial.
It's not 1,000% in stone yet. The lower court now has to go, yeah, we're going to retry him. Or, you know what? We think we had it wrong. No worries, Alec. Sorry. The first of the two, far more likely to happen than them to say, you won this round.
Alec Burda, for all intents and purposes, is going back to trial to relitigate, to re-argue, to maybe re-cry again with snot flying out of his head, just as he did the first round. Maybe there'll be fireworks in the background this time. Who knows? Stranger things have happened. It's 2026. I'm Tony Bruschi. Welcome to round two. Actually, you weren't expecting to hear that one this morning. Neither was I. But last night I got a text message from some folks very close to the case and heard about this and that it was about to drop at any point in time. And just this morning, as I was working on actual other stories, this all came down and I had to pretty much drop everything. So here we are. What does it mean? The written ruling has come down from the South Carolina Supreme Court. Let's go through it. Let's get you up to date. And here we go. Let's put the safety bar down as we get on this ride. The trial of Alec Murdaugh, part due. All right. A jury had doubts. Let that sit for a second. And as we do, maybe you have doubts. Maybe you don't. You probably got some feelings on this. As we weigh through this, I'd love for you to weigh your thoughts out in our comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. So, juror had doubts. Let's sit with that for a second. This is how it all begins. A woman who sat through 6 weeks of testimony, who listened to every witness, who looked at every piece of evidence the South or the state of South Carolina put in front of her. She had questions about whether Alec Murdaugh actually killed his wife and son. She said so in a sworn affidavit. She said so under oath. But before she ever walked into that deliberation room, before she ever cast a vote, the Colleton County Clerk of Court, the woman who now is probably the most popular person in South Carolina, the person whose entire job was to protect the integrity of that trial, had already, if you will, whispered in her ear, "Don't be fooled by the defense. Watch them closely. Look at his actions. Look at his movements." And when deliberation started, someone told the jury, "It shouldn't take long." Juror Z voted guilty. She says she felt pressured. First by those comments, then by the other jurors when she was behind closed doors. The South Carolina Supreme Court just ruled unanimously that she never should have been put in that position. All five justices, no dissent, no partial concurrence, one voice, Alec Murdaugh's murder convictions have been reversed. His life sentences have been vacated. The case has been remanded for a new trial. And the language the court used to get there is unlike anything I've ever read in a judicial opinion. This is per the actual decision, opinion number 28329, meaning the entire court speaks as one. And they do not hold back. The justices wrote that former Colleton County Clerk of Court Becky Hill placed her fingers on the scales of justice, thereby denying Murdaugh his right to a fair trial by an impartial jury. They described her conduct as breathtaking and disgraceful and unprecedented in South Carolina. They said she was attracted by the siren call of celebrity, or at least that's what Toll said earlier. And that she let her hunger for public attention override every obligation she swore to uphold. The court even took a shot at Hill's book, the one she wrote about the trial and then had pulled from the shelves after her co-author accused her of plagiarism. They referenced her December 25 guilty plea to perjury, which came from lying under oath at the very hearing where former Chief Justice Jean Toll was supposed to evaluate whether Hill had tampered with the jury. She did a great job at that, didn't she? No, she didn't. She punted it along. And where she punted it, it got here. And they said, "Whoo, we're sending it back to the other side of the field." Hill allegedly interfered with the jury during the trial. Murtaugh's team filed a motion for a new trial based on that interference. Toll, the judge in the earlier hearings, holds an evidentiary hearing to evaluate that claim. This is kind of the backstory. Hill took the stand at that hearing and lied so clearly that she later pled guilty to perjury for what she said under oath that day. And Toll, relying in part on Hill's testimony in that hearing, denies the motion. The Supreme Court looked at all that and said, no, this is wrong. Start over. You can't have somebody lying on your stand and then you still ruling the way that you did. It's just like, well, go make shit up, whatever you want. We don't care. We're just going to keep, you know, going down the path we're going. None of this matters. It does, though. It matters far beyond the trial of Alec Murtaugh, which is why this decision is the right one. Take what you feel about Alec Murtaugh out of the equation for just a second. I think he's guilty. You probably think he's guilty. The world thinks he's guilty. I think Alec probably knows he's guilty. How exactly he is, I think that has another conversation, which we'll have. But again, take all of that out of the equation. If you have a court system where you clearly have a member of the court, the clerk court, influencing a juror, that juror raising their hand saying, I was influenced by this person saying inappropriate things to me. And the court having to go back and say, well, do we believe you or not? Did it influence the outcome? Clearly it does. If somebody says their opinion, their verdict was influenced, yes, that means it affected it. But for the last year or so, they've been debating that very question. Well, does it really, like, it doesn't matter what your feelings are about Alec Murtaugh, because if you were to let this thing stand, if you were to let this just ride, well, guess what sort of precedent that sets for other cases? Ones where maybe somebody truly is wrongfully convicted. That's not a good precedent. Well, we pushed really hard. And they said so. Even if we broke the rules to get there. No, you can't break the rules to get there. You got to do this. And honestly, if Becky had just shut the F up, none of this would be going on. I think the jury probably would have gotten there. But this was the carrot on the stick. This was the lever that Dick Harpootalian and Team Murtaugh were right to pull. It didn't need to be in front of them. That's the fault of Becky Hill. And the system that employed her, that kept her there, despite knowing she's a little... I'm Becky Hill. You keep people like that on staff, they're cancers, they destroy things. And they just destroyed the biggest, or she just destroyed single-handedly, probably the biggest court case that South Carolina has ever seen because of her ego. Narcissism's neat, isn't it? Gotta promote that self-published plagiarized book of yours that you self-published. I'm sure that was worth it. I'm sure you made a boatload off of that, didn't you? I'm sure it was worth destroying your life. And think of the hundreds, if not thousands, of people this now affects. All because of one person's selfishness, one person's ego, one person's desire to have their opinion heard to a jury. Like, this isn't the place to be influencing. It's like the last place you should be trying to influence a jury because it's criminal. It's against, you can't do that. Or to celebrate, whatever your reasoning was, Becky, hope it was worth it. That's how we got here. So, that's why, in my opinion, I think this was the right decision, although
you know,
it's a pretty dark case. Will it get us closer to answers of what happened here? Maybe. And maybe it's exactly what was convicted the first round, that Alec did it. Or is there more to this case? Is there other people involved? Is there something deeper and darker going on here in the Murdaugh world that we might now unearth? The possibilities are endless. To understand why the court reversed, you need to understand the legal framework that they adopted, because this opinion does more than just fix one case. It changes how South Carolina handles jury tampering claims going forward. The court formally adopted the Fourth Circuit's three-step test from a case called United States versus Cheek. Step one, the defendant has to show that the outside contact with the jury was more than what the court calls an innocuous intervention. Step two, if the defendant clears that low bar, prejudice is presumed automatically. This is called the Raymer presumption, named after the 1954 Supreme Court case. Step three, the burden flips entirely to the state. The prosecution has to prove there is no reasonable possibility that the jury's verdict was influenced by the improper contact. Not that it probably wasn't influenced. There is no reasonable possibility it was. That is a heavy burden, and the court said so explicitly. Toll got this all backwards. She put the burden on Murdaugh to prove that Hill's comments actually changed the outcome. That is the opposite of what the law requires. Good job, Gene. Time to go back to retirement. The Supreme Court said it was wrong as a matter of law, not a judgment call, not a close question, but a legal error. But Toll made a second mistake. That might be even more significant. She questioned the jurors about whether Hill's comments affected their votes. She asked them directly, did this influence your verdict? And she used their answers, particularly the answers that said no, it didn't, to justify denying a new trial motion. Time to go back to retirement, Gene. Who else did you fail in your career? The Supreme Court ruled that this violated Rule 606B of the South Carolina Rules of Evidence. That rule exists to protect what happens inside a jury room. You can ask a juror what outside contact they were exposed to. You can ask them what a third party said to them, but you cannot ask them whether it changed their mind. You cannot ask them to open up their deliberative process and tell you how they voted or why. Toll did exactly that and then built her ruling on the answers. The Supreme Court said the post-trial court should never have asked those questions and should never have relied on those responses. Funny thing is, if she did rely on the responses, she would have sent this back for a retrial. But who's the one who didn't like the answers that round? It was Gene Toll, not a juror. The court went so far as to overrule one of its own prior decisions, a case called Ether. To make this point crystal clear, this is not something the South Carolina Supreme Court does casually. Now, here's where it gets worse, because the Supreme Court didn't just say Toll applied the wrong legal standard. They independently reviewed the record and concluded that Hill made a broader set of improper comments than Toll's order even acknowledged. Toll's order referenced only a couple of Hill's statements, that the day Murdaugh testified was an important day or an epic day, and that jurors should watch his body language. The state argued that Toll implicitly rejected the other alleged comments as not credible. The Supreme Court said that argument has no merit. The court found that Hill told jurors not to be fooled by the defense's evidence, not to be confused or thrown off or convinced by Murdaugh's attorneys. She told them to watch Murdaugh closely, to look at his actions and his movements. The alternate juror testified that Hill stood in the doorway and said, quote, they're going to say things that will try to confuse you. Don't let them confuse you or convince you or throw you off. And when deliberations began, Hill or someone on her staff told the jury, it shouldn't take long. The court compared Hill's conduct to the bailiff in Parker v. Gladden in 1966. It was a case, the United States Supreme Court case. In Parker, a bailiff told jurors, oh, that wicked fellow, he is guilty. Hill didn't use those exact words, but the South Carolina Supreme Court found she accomplished pretty much the same thing.
She effectively became an uninstructed character witness for the prosecution. She attacked Murdaugh's credibility. She urged the jury to reject his defense, and she did it from a position of enormous authority. She was the elected clerk of court, elected by the very people who made up the Colleton County jury pool. As the court noted, that official status, beyond question, carries great weight with a jury. The state threw everything they had at rebutting the presumption of prejudice. None of it worked. They said only three jurors heard the comments. Only. The court cited Parker again. A defendant is entitled to 12 impartial jurors, not 9 or 10. They said the evidence against Murdaugh was overwhelming. The court pushed back on that characterization, noting that the state's case rested largely on circumstantial evidence and that Murdaugh's credibility was central to his defense, meaning Hill's comments attacking that credibility went to the heart of the case. They said the trial court standard jury instructions cured any harm. The Supreme Court pointed out that Judge Newman never knew about Hill's comments until months after the verdict. There was nothing to cure. The standard instructions could retroactively fix that kind of interference. Then no defendant would ever get relief when a court officer poisons the jury. And the Constitution cannot allow that. And then there's the motive. The court found, as a factual matter based on testimony from the Barnwell County clerk who assisted at trial, that Hill repeatedly said she wanted to write a book so she could buy a lake house, and that a guilty verdict would be the best day to sell copies. Hill denied wanting a guilty verdict for financial reasons, but the court didn't buy it. They found she acknowledged in her book that she believed Murdaugh was guilty and was worried he'd be acquitted because of his family's connection. She had a rooting interest in the outcome. She was not a neutral officer of the court. She was a participant with a financial stake in conviction, and she acted on it, no matter how small it is, no matter how delusional she is, that her little book, self-published, is going to buy her a lake house. How about a lake outhouse? Did you get that? Most of the coverage of this ruling is going to focus on the jury tampering reversal, and rightfully so. But the court did something else in this opinion that could reshape what the retrial actually looks like, and almost nobody is talking about it yet. The court issued guidance on the admissibility of Murdaugh's financial crimes evidence, and that guidance is a significant problem for the prosecution. At the first trial, the state spent, by the court's own calculation, 12 and a half hours of testimony before the jury, spread over 10 days of trial, presenting evidence about Murdaugh's financial schemes. The stolen client funds, the fake forge accounts, the Satterfield insurance proceeds, the missing attorney's fees, witness after witness after witness. The court unanimously held that the trial court allowed the state to go, quote, far too long and far too deep into details that had nothing to do with motive. The court used a specific example. Tony Satterfield testified about why he and not his brother served as a personal representative in the legal matter involving their late mother. Satterfield explained that his brother is a vulnerable adult with a disability. The state repeated the phrase. The court asked him to repeat it again. The testimony had, in the court's words, zero probative value as to why Murdaugh allegedly committed murder. But it had enormous potential to make the jury see Murdaugh as someone who takes advantage of the helpless. That is propensity evidence dressed up as motive evidence. And the Supreme Court called it out directly. Now, here is the key distinction. The court did not say all financial crime evidence must be excluded at a retrial. They acknowledge the trial court acted within its discretion in admitting some of the evidence. The state's motive theory that Murdaugh's financial schemes were about to be exposed and he needed to buy time is a legally permissible theory. Evidence supporting that theory can come in. But the court made clear that on retrial, the state must present that evidence efficiently without the lengthy presentation of inflammatory details with little to no probative value. No more marathon financial testimony in the sequel. No more parading individual clients and their suffering before the jury when that suffering has nothing to do with the question of whether Murdaugh committed murder on June 7th of 2021. The court also noted that not all of its members would have admitted the financial evidence at all. Some justices would have excluded it entirely had they been the trial judge. They deferred to the trial court's discretion on that call, but the message is clear. Whoever presides over a retrial needs to hold the prosecution to a much tighter leash on the evidence, and that changes the dynamics of the case considerably. The financial crimes evidence was arguably the most emotionally powerful part of the state's first presentation, not because it proved who pulled the trigger, but because it made the jury desperate, or rather despise, the defendant. A retrial without that level of detail is a fundamentally different proceeding. So where does this leave things? Well, Alec Murdaugh is not walking out of prison. He is still serving consecutive sentences, 27 years at a state level and 40 years in federal prison for the financial crimes he admitted to and pled guilty to. Those sentences are not affected by this ruling, but his murder convictions are vacated. His life sentences are gone. And as of this ruling, he is once again presumed innocent on the charges of killing Maggie and Paul Murdaugh. We have to start putting that word alleged now in front of it. The decision to retry belongs to Attorney General Alan Wilson, whose office prosecuted the first trial. Wilson has already gone on the record saying he will retry the case. Every candidate running to replace him when his term ends has said the same thing. Lead prosecutor Creighton Waters would presumably handle the case again. Can we try somebody else? But no judge has been assigned, no venue has been set yet, and there is no deadline for the state to formally make its decision, although every indication is that a second trial is coming. The open questions are enormous. Where do you seat a jury for what might have been the most publicized criminal trial in South Carolina history? Probably the biggest trial that we've seen actively take place in a decade here for the entire country. A case that has spawned documentaries, podcasts, miniseries, books. Which judge takes the bench, knowing the Supreme Court just reversed the last proceeding and issued detailed guidance on what the next one has to look like? How does the state build its case when the court just told them their financial evidence presentation was excessive and unfairly prejudicial? Does Murdaugh take the stand again, knowing his credibility is a central battleground? Does the defense have access to anything new after three additional years of investigation, legal proceedings, and Becky Hill's criminal conviction? And then there's the bigger picture. This opinion is not about whether Alec Murdaugh killed his wife and son. The South Carolina Supreme Court did not weigh in on the guilt or innocence of Alec Murdaugh. Understand that. They weighed in on the process. They looked at what happened inside that courthouse at a clerk of court who whispered to jurors, who told them not to believe a defendant, who wanted a conviction to sell books, and they said the system failed. The right to a fair trial is not a technicality. It is not a loophole, and the entire foundation of the system is based on it. And when an officer of the court puts her thumb on the scale, the verdict can't stand, no matter how guilty you think the guy is. It does not matter how strong the evidence is. It does not matter how unsympathetic the defendant is. It does not matter how much time and money the first trial cost. The Constitution does not have an exception for people we think probably did it. That's the principle. Whether Alec Murdaugh killed Maggie and Paul, that question now goes back to a jury, a new jury, a new courtroom, without Becky Hill anywhere near it. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I would love for you to weigh in, and I'd love to hear what you think. Here we go again. Going down the only road I've ever known. Okay. Anyway, your thoughts, comment section, Substack, YouTube. It's going to be a lot. I can't believe we're here again. We're going to be talking, by the way, press subscribe, Blanca Simpson, who was Alec Murdaugh's housekeeper after the other one died. She's going to be with us on the program. And she's already been on the program in the past. If you want to go back and find that interview, it's very fascinating, but she's also going to be with us, here in the next coming days. She's absorbing the information right now as well. She's kind of shocked, even though she kind of knew this was coming. But she's going to be joining us, as well. And we're going to get her reaction and her thoughts on what might be happening here and what to expect.
She has a lot of information she's talked about that never made it to trial. What might make it this time? Stay with us to find out. Press subscribe.
Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.